Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. And David Seeloff is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And you can find the website at askelm.com. And we are working on a series. It is the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world, and today begins Chapter 10. Hi, David.
Hi, Jordan. Is my voice cracked?
Well, not as bad as mine. I'll tell you, I'm really having a time with my voice.
Well, as we're progressing through this book, The Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world, we're coming to Chapter 10, which is titled The War That No One Can Find. And it deals with a major war that the Jews had with Rome in the dark decade between 6 BC to 4 AD. And going on with the text, Roman historians have expressed a great deal of uncertainty about events that happened during the period from 6 BC to 4 AD. They call it the Dark Decade. Now, to be sure, there are several records of various events which occurred at this time, but they are often contradictory and not complete, or else they are heavily flavored with excess, bias, and flattery. Most historians prefer to walk cautiously within the history of this period. However, the research that we're providing in this book, Dr. Martin reading his words, the research we're providing in this book can bring much enlightenment to this time period. The key to the whole thing is to find the year in which King Herod died. Once it is realized that this happened in early 1 BC and not in 4 BC, an abundance of historical evidence just bursts on the scene that can take away much of the ambiguity with which this period bristles. The fact is, scholars have been misplacing major events some 3 years too early in the history of Rome and Palestine. But once the reconstruction of the chronological events is recognized, the historical records, which have come down to us, begin to make perfectly good sense. As an example, a major war occurred within this period, but the proof of its existence has eluded historians over the years. They cannot find it because they tried to place it 3 years before it actually occurred. But by dating King Herod's death in 1 BC, which is proper to do, it's now possible to find several Roman documents that mention not only the war, but other historical events of the period begin to make sense. What is that war that presently cannot be found? Well, this is the war that Jewish scholars call the War of Varus. It was the war that took place in Galilee, Judea, and Idumea just after the death of Herod, that started with the massacre of the 3,000 Jewish worshippers in the temple at the Passover of 1 BC. Josephus stated that this war against the Jews, which was directed by the governor of Syria, who was called Quintilius Varus, took place in Palestine. But it has been a puzzle to historians that there appear to be no contemporary Roman accounts that justify it as occurring. Imagine a period in the remote future when some Iraqi documents might be found of a war in Iraq in which American, British, French, and other allied forces fought against Iraq, which scholars at that future time misdated to 1998. But try as they may, no records could be found in the United States that such a war took place in that year. If, however, those future historians look at United States records for January or February of 1991, 3 years after 1998, they would have an abundance of records that such a war occurred. Well, this is the very thing that happened to the War of Verus, which took place in the spring and summer of the year following King Herod's death. Jewish records make it clear that this major war occurred, but there is no Roman testimony, whether it be literature, coins, or inscriptions, that would justify such a war in 4 BC. But let's be clear. If there are no records if we place the War of Verus in 4 BC, as most scholars have done. But if the war is correctly dated 3 years later, to 1 BC, we find that there are a number of important Roman references to the war. Everything makes sense in a remarkable way. Now, about the War of Verus. This was a significant war. Josephus states that for Rome to gain the victory, it involved the totality of the regular Roman military forces in the province of Syria, which was about 20,000 men, involving 3 legions, plus usually an equal number of auxiliaries and allied troops. This war was located in what Rome considered to be one of the most strategic regions in the empire. In no way could this war be called a minor skirmish. It was well recognized in Jewish circles, both ancient and modern, that this was one of the most serious military operations to occur in Palestine from the time of Pompey, which in 63 BC, until the Roman-Jewish War of AD 66 to 73. Now, such a war had national as well as international implications. About 1/10 of the entire Roman Empire's population was Jewish. Now, they were scattered in most of the cities, but there were heavy concentrations of Jews in the east, in the eastern portion of the empire. Not only that, there were probably as many Jews in Parthia, which was Rome's archenemy, as there were in Palestine. Any war involving Jewish revolutionaries, which took 3 Roman legions plus auxiliaries to overcome, could not have been a minor military action. Wars involving the Jews were not looked upon by the Romans as mere provincial affairs of little importance, especially if those wars were based upon Jewish messianic expectations. This was always a problem for Rome. The messianic aspects of the War of Verus was evident. Over 6,000 Pharisees, not long before the war, had predicted to the house of Pheroras, the brother of King Herod, that Herod's kingdom was prophesied to end, and, quote, the eunuch would then have children. Now, this was clearly the messianic age that they were predicting to come with signs and miracles. The Pharisees were very popular leaders of the Jews and the ones that most lay people looked to with confidence for scholarship. The majority of the Jewish population was then expecting a world-ruling messianic king to arise on the historical scene. And indeed, Josephus tells us that after Herod's death, many, quote, kingly upstarts, end quote, emerged in Judea, and this reflects the general expectancy of the Jews that the Messianic age was then imminent. Rome would have been well aware of these national aspirations of the Jews. And when the revolt broke out after the 3,000 Jews were massacred in the temple during Passover, and since the event had Messianic overtones to it, Rome flexed its legionary muscles to quell the uprising. Since the Jews in Parthia would have totally known what was going on in Judea, and with Parthia a rival of Rome anyway, this was no time for Rome to be resting on its laurels. With the Jews in revolt, it was an indispensable time for Rome to take action and to get their armed forces to full strength. In such a situation, the security of the eastern provinces of the empire, if not the empire itself, was at stake. Now, one of the principal reasons that Rome gave King Herod the kingship of Judea was to make him a bulwark against the Parthians. By the way, these are all cited in the notes. For example, what I just read was cited from Josephus. While King Herod was alive, he did just that. He provided a wall against others for the Romans. But now, with Herod dead and his kingdom in rebellion, with the full armed forces of the Romans in Syria fighting to overcome it, and with only the client kings in Asia Minor of Cappadocia, Pontus, and Commagene protecting the frontiers with Parthia, which was an expansionist empire at that time itself, it was no time for Rome to be discharging professionally trained legionnaires from the armed services. But note this, if the War of Varus took place in the summer and autumn of 4 BC, as scholars have felt up to now, a most unlikely state of affairs was then happening in the Roman military. We have the plain statement of Augustus, Emperor Augustus himself, that he had been steadily discharging many of his soldiers and giving them handsome bonuses from the period of 7 to 2 BC. And this is in Augustus' own writings. Within that six-year period, there were no major wars involving Roman troops while this continual discharging of troops, of soldiers, was going on. And though Augustus tells us that there was a temporary respite from the discharges in 5 BC, from 4 BC on to and including 2 BC, the demobilization of the Roman Empire continued unabated. Rome fought no wars from 7 to 2 BC. Now, Professor Syme describes the discharging of these soldiers at this period as evidence that peace and security was found throughout the empire. Quote, the titulature of the ruler, meaning Augustus, registers no fresh imperatorial salutation for many years after he was acclaimed Imperator 15 in 8 BC. And this is in Sir Ronald Syme, The Crisis of 2 BC. Salutations such as these were given to emperors when the Romans had secured victories in war. But none were given to Augustus from the period of 8 BC up to and including 2 BC. So peaceful was this period that Syme describes only the third closing of the temple doors of the god Janus in Rome at this time. This was a sign that peace was then secure throughout the Roman Empire. And with the steady demobilization of legionnaries from 7 to 2 BC, with the exception of the period, a short period in 5 BC, it surely indicates a time of peace and harmony throughout the empire. Now, for a difficulty, scholars today who place Herod's death in early 4 BC are also required to place the War of Varus, Quintilius Varus, in the summer of 4 BC, right in the middle of this Augustan peace. They have to do so because of their erroneous selection of the March 13, 4 BC eclipse of the moon that was associated with the death of King Herod. But this is nonsense, and this makes the Roman records 3 years out of phase with the reality of events. Herod actually died in January 1 BC. This means that the War of Varus took place in the summer and autumn of that year, immediately after King Herod died. Look at what this means and how sensible the historical records now become. Augustus steadily discharged his legionnaires from 7 to 2 BC, and there was peace throughout the whole empire during that period of time. But with the Palestinian War breaking out in the spring of 1 BC, the demobilization of the legions stopped. The Romans from then on mustered their armed forces and their reserves for a time of war. The same thing happened with the United States when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. the United States quit discharging military men, even lengthening the stay of those scheduled to be discharged, and called up the reserves to fight a significant war in the volatile Middle East. The similarities are actually quite interesting. Now, correctly, we're going to consider the correct dating of the War of Verus. The War of Verus actually broke out in Palestine in 1 BC. And at that very time, the Roman records show that the Armenians in the northeastern section of the empire also began to stir up rebellion. While this was happening, the Parthians further east, also in 1 BC, maneuvered to take advantage of the deteriorating military situation in Rome's eastern provinces. Understanding that the War of Verus was in 1 BC can make these known activities of the Armenians and the Parthians completely understandable. There was another prime reason why we can know that the War of Verus was in 1 BC. When significant conflicts took place outside the official boundaries of the empire, such as the war just after King Herod's death, it was customary for the emperor to be awarded what's called an imperial acclamation if victory was achieved by Rome. And as Professor Syme has noted, Roman records show that Augustus did in fact receive such an acclamation. It was his 14th acclamation in 8 BC, but not another until 1 AD, the year 1 AD. If Verus War occurred in 4 BC, as scholars have wanted to believe, why was there not an acclamation in 4 or 3 BC? It was, after all, a Roman victory. That victory over the Jews had all the earmarks of gaining such an award for Augustus. But if that war and victory were in 1 BC, as was actually the case, then the acclamation 15 in the following year of 1 AD becomes perfectly reasonable. Professor Barnes, in the Journal of Roman Studies, 1974, page 23, where's my place error? Professor Barnes has made it clear that the war which gave Augustus his acclamation 15 in 1 to 2 AD must have occurred sometime between June 2 BC and 1 AD. Well, the dating of the War of Verus to the summer of 1 BC fits the historical scenario perfectly. Augustus' acclamation 15 was actually given to him for Verus' victory over the Jewish rebellion. Even though he didn't actually do the fighting, he still, as emperor, awarded that honor. Indeed, there's even far more to it than that. When the proper chronology is recognized, more historical material can be understood about Roman affairs in the eastern provinces. And we'll look at this matter more closely. And Roman history can now make sense. We have stated that the lunar eclipse associated with King Herod's death was that of January 10th, 1 BC. Two prominent rabbis were martyred on the eve of that eclipse. A few weeks later, the Passover occurred, on which 3,000 Jews met their deaths in the temple precincts in protest over the rabbis' executions. This led to the outbreak of war in late spring of 1 BC, and Verus entered the conflict in early summer. In the meantime, Archelaus, the successor of Herod, had sailed to Rome to plead his case that Herod's kingdom should be given to him. He was out of the country of Judea. When Augustus in Rome heard the case for and against Archelaus in late spring, he had at his side his grandson, Gaius Caesar, who was later known as Caligula. But soon, knowledge of the new Palestinian war and the seriousness of it reached Rome. This was the time when Gaius Caesar was dispatched hurriedly to Syria, quote, under the stress of necessity, end quote, as it says in the historian Cassius Dio, in his works, it looks like Gaius Caesar was sent via the lower Danube regions. The primary purpose of his mission was to compose the troubles in Armenia. This is according to Tacitus in his book Annals, Book 4, Section 1. What a logical time for the Armenians in the northeastern frontier of the empire to start trouble. With Varus and all the legions of Syria then fighting a major war in the south of, to the south of Syria in Palestine, this left a power vacuum in Roman military defense in the border areas with Parthia and in Armenia. Gaius Caesar's assignment was to speed toward Armenia through the Danube region to gain allies for the Romans. Now, why did he actually go through the Danube? Well, the Roman historian Tacitus tells us that the strategic reserves of the Roman armed forces were located in Dalmatia. And this is again in Tacitus. Two extra legions were stationed in that area specifically for deployment purposes in times of national emergency. Because they were kind of halfway, the west and the east, so they could, if there was a problem in Rome or with the Gauls or the Germans, they could go north or west. If there was a problem, as there was, in the east, they could go east. These were special troops that were trained to speed to areas of need. Another Roman historian, Dio Cassius, said that Gaius Caesar had been given the command of the Danube regions in 2 BC, at the time when everything was peaceful. And there was a general peace from 7 to 2 BC, but with the revolt in Judea starting in the spring of 1 BC, followed soon with the insurrection in Armenia and the stirrings in Parthia, well, diligent and decisive action was then needed, and Gaius was tasked and sent to the east, and he traveled to the east to put down these belligerent maneuvers by the various peoples. When Gaius Caesar was given charge of the Danube legions in 2 BC, the Roman historian Velleius Paterculus said he had made a leisurely journey through some of the provinces under his command, but now, in midsummer of 1 BC, he was, quote, dispatched to Syria, end quote, and, quote, under the stress of necessity, end quote. Since the Danube regions were his direct responsibility as commander, he no doubt, would have been commander under Gaius Caesar, he no doubt mustered some of the reserve forces located at that region and promptly hastened them toward Syria. It is interesting that when Varus went to war against the Jews, there were only three legions in Syria. But in the early years of Tiberius, a few years later, there were four legions, according to Tacitus. Now, it is very possible that one of the reserve legions was sent at Gaius' behest to buttress the three Syrian legions normally stationed in the area. This movement of troops to the eastern frontier at this time is substantiated by Professor Syme, referring to the comments of Velleius Paterculus. I have trouble with his name. And this is in Syme's History in Ovid. A strange thing then happened to Gaius before reaching Armenia. When he came to the island of Samos in the Aegean Sea, he met the exiled Tiberius, who later himself also became emperor before Gaius Caesar. From that encounter, he made the decision, Tiberius had been exiled by Augustus. From that encounter between Gaius Caesar and Tiberius, Gaius made the decision to go first to Egypt and then to the northern parts of Arabia. Well, what an odd route to take if he was supposed to be heading directly to, quote, compose the troubles in Armenia, end quote. So why did Gaius go to Egypt, and why was it necessary to be in northern Arabia in the early summer and the early in the late summer and early autumn of 1 BC? Well, the answer comes from a first century Roman historian called Pliny. He said that Gaius went into Arabia to achieve military victories. He went to fight a war. By the way, before Gaius Caesar had some type of brain disease and went mad when he was emperor, shortly after he became emperor, he was a very competent military leader. Back to the text. Interestingly, Pliny said these military accomplishments of Gaius occurred north of the Gulf of Aqaba. He only looked at the Arabian Peninsula. He did not enter it. And this is in this tells us something about the area of Gaius' battles. And this is in Pliny's Natural History, Book 12. Now, Gaius' battle was actually in Palestine. This war that Gaius Caesar fought was either to the east of the Arava, the region between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba, or to the west of it. If it was to the east, he would have been in conflict most likely with the Nabataean Arabs. Professor Bowersock, though, discounts this possibility since the Nabataeans were noted for their docility and their unbellicose manner of life. This is according to Strabo, Book 16. And this evaluation is true. Even in the War of Varus, the Romans had to dismiss the Nabataeans as being unreliable in fighting the Jewish rebels in Idumea. This is according to Josephus. It is almost certain that Gaius' victories were accomplished west of the Arava Wadi. This region was the southern part of King Herod's kingdom, known as Idumea. And remarkably, this location is the very region where the last fighting in the War of Varus took place. There were 10,000 Jewish insurgents in the area that had to be pacified. Once again, according to Josephus. And note this, last bit of mopping up operations, as our new chronological reconstruction shows, occurred in the autumn of 1 BC. This would have been the exact time that Gaius Caesar was in the region securing those victories that brought him fame. So important was this expedition of Gaius that the celebrated King Juba of Mauritania wrote an account of it and dedicated the book to Gaius himself. And this is according to Pliny's Natural History. This war was not a minor affair. It now looks probable that when Gaius Caesar reached Samos in the Aegean, he was told that the conflict in Palestine was about to end. His presence at the conclusion of the war could help stabilize the whole region and give Rome an imperial victory, with himself as the heir to the empire commanding the final military actions. So Gaius, instead of going to Armenia, went first to Egypt and hurriedly continued on to Idumea to bring the war in Palestine to an end. After all, he was part of the imperial family. So he then went to Jerusalem, where he failed to allow the customary devotions to be given, quote, to the Jewish God, end quote, according to Suetonius, the Roman historian Suetonius, in his chapter on Augustus. From there, he and Varus must have gone to Antioch with two of the legions, while one legion was left in Judea. He would have arrived in the provincial capital of Antioch by late 1 BC, or at the beginning of 1 AD. He would then have joined forces with the one or two legions he sent to Syria from the Danubian reserves. This would have given him the needed reinforcements he required for his own operations soon to occur against the Armenians. But this does not end the story. History can now make sense. Two other historical documents, which now make sense, whereas before they were a puzzle to historians. There is an eyewitness account of the War of Varus which tells about the person who secured the victory. This Jewish writer, who lived in Judea, he wrote a book called The Assumption of Moses. He said that the war was conducted by a king who had come from the west to gain the triumph. This is in The Assumption of Moses, 6, section 8. The reference has normally been applied to Quintilius Varus because historians up to now have assumed the war mentioned by this Jewish writer took place in 4 BC. This, of course, was 3 years before Gaius Caesar arrived on the scene in late 1 BC. But we now know that Gaius was in this very region at the conclusion of the War of Varus. And much truer to the Jewish author's account, Gaius came directly from the west to end the war, and he had all the credentials to be called a king. Quintilius Varus hardly fits the account. The Roman governor was not a king, and he came from the north, not from the west. Even this reference is helpful in showing that the War of Varus ended in 1 BC, and that Gaius, who was a king, certainly in the future, was there to help in the mopping up operations. And ancient inscriptions also help us. The next point is even more significant. In 1960, an inscription was found in Greece which mentions these activities of Gaius while he was on his mission to the east. It refers to some splendid victories, and though it does not specify what those victories were, they were written on what was written on this inscription has an important bearing on our question under discussion. The inscription states, quote, "Gaius, the son of Augustus, who was fighting the barbarians for the safety of all mankind," end quote. So important was the conclusion of this war mentioned on the inscription that it records there were, quote, "lavish and varied spectacles," so that what took place then rivaled what had come before, end quote. And this is all in Zetzel's Greek, Roman, and Byzantine Studies, Book 11 in 1970. For festivals of victory to be held as far away as Greece, from Rome as Greece, that were so sumptuous and had to be continued annually that nothing had ever excelled them, surely means that some conquest of great importance was being celebrated. It must have been a prominent triumph because it was reckoned that Gaius had been fighting, quote, "for the safety of all mankind," end quote. Even when one allows for inscriptural adulation and exaggeration, it's hardly possible that the inscription is referring to some minor skirmishes. The victory in some major war was being honored. But what war could this have been? Because scholars have misdated the War of Varus in the past to 4 BC, only the suggestion for any 1 BC conflict has been the possibility of Rome fighting against some nomadic Arabs wandering up from the Arabian Peninsula. But one wonders how a Roman victory over some Arab intruders at that time could be construed as being, quote, "for the safety of all mankind." But if the inscription is telling about the War of Varus in 1 BC, the information it records makes perfectly good sense. The inscription also states that Gaius was victorious over barbarians. The term can be interpreted variously, but it would apply most particularly to people who lived outside the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Added to this, we have the Pison Cenotaph, which contains another inscription, which mentions this same expedition of Gaius, and it states that Gaius' victories were accomplished, quote, "beyond the Roman frontiers," end quote. This is in Bowersock's, the Journal of Roman Studies. The region of Idumea in 1 BC would fit the description precisely. The area of Galilee, Judea, and Perea across east of the Jordan River, and Idumea, south of and east of the Dead Sea, were formerly the lands controlled by King Herod. Though Herod was associated politically with the empire in close alliance, his kingdom was technically outside imperial territory. King Herod was considered a client king, semi-independent, like the king of Armenia. It only became a province in 6 to 7 AD when Quirinius assumed the governorship of Syria and Palestine. However, in 1 BC, Idumea was still, quote, beyond the Roman frontiers, end quote, as far as the Roman government was concerned. Besides this, there were other reasons to call the area of Palestine barbarian at that time. Rome would have considered the Jewish rebels as fighting against the philosophical and political concepts within the Hellenistic principles that then dominated Roman thinking. In other words, they were rebelling against the Babylonian system, in a sense, even though they were actually part of it. They thought they were fighting against it. If there were any people at the time who would naturally have been against such Roman philosophical thinking and would have been called barbarians, it would have been the Jews of Palestine after the death of King Herod. This would especially have been true because they had just fought a major war with Verus and his Roman legions. We have some modern parallels. Recall that during World War II, the Americans, British, and other allies were quite accustomed to calling Germans and Japanese barbarians. And of course, the Axis powers had uncomplimentary things to say about the Allied powers. It is the nature of humans to use such terms in times of war or in their immediate aftermath. Thus, it is no problem in believing that the Romans would have referred to the Jews at this time as barbarians. This belief is further strengthened because the inscription found in 1960 stated that Gaius had been fighting, quote, for the safety of all mankind, end quote. The Romans must have considered their victory to be of great consequence. After all, as was stated before, there were Jews who had messianic convictions at that time scattered throughout the empire of Rome as well as throughout the Parthian Empire. What if all the Jews everywhere decided to fight against Rome? This, of course, was an unlikely proposition, but the potential of such a thing was always there. There was also the possibility of for fifth column subversion by the Jews, as well as their active aggression against the empire, which gave Rome concern. Putting an end to the resistance in Palestine must have given the Romans the feeling of having accomplished a major victory. It could have been stated that Gaius' final victories in Idumea were, quote, for the safety of all mankind, end quote. Such an appraisal is reflective of Roman beliefs at this period. Tacitus, a century later, gave ordinary Roman opinion of the Jews when he said they customarily hated, quote, all mankind, end quote. And this is in Zetzel's Greek and Roman Byzantine Studies again. Even the Apostle Paul felt that Jewish social beliefs at the time were, quote, contrary to all men, according to 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 15. Josephus records a plethora of Gentile antipathy against the Jews within this period we're discussing. The Emperor Claudius wrote to the people of Alexandria in 41 AD, saying that the Jews and their opinions were, quote, a general plague infecting the whole world, end quote. We only give these references to show the ordinary Roman belief about the Jewish population during the period of our discussion. If there was ever a people out of step with the rest of the world at that time, it was the Jews. And it is well within reason that those mentioned in the inscription as being like barbarians that Gaius subdued for the safety of all mankind were the final Jewish insurgents in Idumea who fought the war of Verus. Now, once these historical indications are placed into proper chronological sequence, as we're showing, as Dr. Martin is showing in this book, the history of the eastern provinces becomes sensible. It could even be said that the basic information in the New Testament that Jesus was born before the death of Herod, coupled with the history of Josephus, that Herod died not long after the eclipse of the moon of January 10th, 1 BC, are the very keys that make the Roman historical records understandable. Truly, King Herod died in 1 BC, and the War of Verus took place in the summer and autumn of 1 BC, with Gaius Caesar in Idumea for the conclusion of that war. The historical records become perfectly understandable. This means that the War of Verus has been found within the Roman and Greek records after all. It also allows the historical statements of the New Testament concerning the nativity of Jesus to take on a new credibility from a purely historical source. Jesus was born in 3 BC, within the period stated by most early Christian scholars. And now we have this substantiated by the records of Roman history. So ends chapter 10, The War That No One Can Find. Thank you, Georgianne.
Oh, David, as usual, you certainly bring a great deal of information that most of us would not know otherwise. And it's very valuable to know about history.
Now this particular, as we've noticed in earlier chapters, there have been bits and pieces that other people have about the eclipse and about the birth of Christ. And of course, all the early church fathers had him born earlier than 4 BC, like 6 or 7. But this particular historical reconstruction is totally unique to Dr. Martin, and he deserves credit for a original solution to this historical problem.
You know, also, when we talk about Jesus Christ, there is some person on the internet out there, David, that's going around saying, and the emails are circulating widely, that, how can we trust that this resurrection business, because there were so many other reported cases of messiahs that were resurrected.
Well, actually not.
Yeah, I know. But you see, these people have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience is usually quite ignorant of historical fact. And that's why history is just, it is so important to understand it and to have access to it. I think you know what I'm saying here.
Oh, I have several friends who promote that very idea. I was trying to think of them and trying to think whether the term several justifies that phrase, but indeed there are several. And there would probably be people that you would, names you would recognize. But it's interesting, that's simply historically wrong. And if you want, you can just go to Mercy Aliotti. He was the editor of, unfortunately I can't think of the work, this massive work, Encyclopedia of History and Religion. Mercy Aliotti was the editor-in-chief. And in the book on Christs, in the article on Christs, or dying and rising saviors. That's what it is. And I think we've covered this in one of the presentations in regarding the sons of God. It's actually not the case. They didn't rise. They were raised up among the stars or something like that. They were not physically raised to, you know, before a spiritual resurrection. It just didn't happen. It didn't happen the way the Bible describes it. And these people were never seen after they died.
Yeah.
That's a big difference. They were just proclaimed as being, there was no eyewitnesses. They were just being proclaimed as gods. And that was determined to be their resurrection. You know, similarity is not identity.
Yeah, no fooling. But, you know, you see, this kind of stuff is designed, whether the people are conscious of it or not, it is designed to bring people into questioning Scripture, into questioning their faith. You know?
Right. And the resurrection is the key.
Right.
And as we're seeing, you know, the Bible is totally reliable even on the birth of Christ.
Right.
But the resurrection is key, and as we've mentioned elsewhere in other presentations, the purpose of the Bible, even though it's historically true and accurate, the purpose of the Bible is not to prove that Christ is the Messiah, the resurrected Messiah. It's simply to proclaim that Christ is the resurrected Messiah, and it also happens to be true historically. But that's not it. That's not the purpose that was it was set out. That's not why Scripture was produced. It was not produced to set out the proofs. It was merely to proclaim the message, and the proofs follow along from the historical and matter of fact and eyewitness material that follows. And part of that is the eyewitness material of Mary, because after all, where did the gospel writers get the information about Mary? They got it from Mary.
Yes.
She was still alive afterwards, and once these things were written down, she was a young woman when Jesus was born.
Yes.
She was 14, 15. She may have been as young as 13. I don't know. It was not uncommon in those days to marry that young. You could even be married before puberty, but that doesn't mean that, you left your mother's house to marry. It was more of a legal sense or an engagement.
Betrothal,
right. So it varied from village to village and from group to group, and certainly even the Jewish methodologies varied from time to time, and they're considerably different now than they were back in the first century for various reasons. So, you know, all these things dovetail that Mary was the source for the birth narrative. They didn't make this stuff up. They had a source for it. This is quite clear from John and Luke and Matthew and the others. And whether, you know, the whole aspect of the star, it obviously was not made up because there was something that happened in the sky during that time. Now, you know, were Luke and Matthew and those who told the birth narratives, they were all young people, the same age as Christ pretty much, when these things all took place. So they got the information from somebody else. And that information we now know is reliable. So, but the purpose is not to prove that Christ is reliable. It just happens that the Scripture has sufficient information that we can trust the information that's in there to be truthful. So, yeah, and now a major hole in Roman history has been worked out and with regarding this the wars of Quintilius Varus. So
Well, it's interesting that, you know, there are these misguided people that portray themselves as such, you know, new thinkers.
there's people like Gerald Massey,
yeah,
who have been putting this stuff out. But if you read Massey's material, he doesn't footnote anything.
Yeah,
you could spend a lifetime trying to track down his sources. And, you know, I looked at it and I said, I don't have time for this.
Yeah,
I've got my own work to do and you know, material. So Massey is spouting this stuff off, and the books get reprinted, and people take this at face value. But if somebody doesn't cite his sources, it's like some conspiracy insider books where, you know, and I could name names, and people do not cite sources. Their stuff is, how do we know if they're misinformed, they don't know what they're talking about, or they're disinformation people?
That's right.
I don't know. Maybe Gerald Massey had a chip on his shoulder. I have no reason to believe so, but how do I know? Unless I can double-check what he writes.
That's right.
And you can do that with scripture in many cases, most cases, for historical events. And sometimes you have to wait. We have more information now than they had available in the first century.
Right.
And same with what Dr. Martin writes. You can verify, and I've been going into a lot of the documents that have been written, the articles and the books, and putting websites where you can read the actual words. And yes, the translations might vary, but that's normal. You know, a translation of Tacitus in one book, in one website, might be different than another. But what Dr. Martin cited was correct in, you know, many cases, unless there was a typo. And that happens too. So it's interesting that it's difficult to check the critics. And once that happens, an alarm bell goes off in my mind saying, okay, that's nice, but what does that prove? Why should I take that at face value?
Yes.
And take that at faith? I don't have to do that. Now, I have to take the resurrection at faith, on faith, simply because I was not there. I did not eyewitness that event. But there were people who were eyewitnesses who wrote down their accounts. And those accounts, even the variant accounts, can be worked out and understood. And that's fascinating. Now that takes some work. But we're supposed to grow in faith and knowledge, or in grace and in knowledge. And knowledge takes work. And we're supposed to study to show ourselves approved for the, you know, for what we believe. So it's not always easy. And a lot of people, Georgianne, want it handed to them on a silver platter.
Sure.
This is the truth about this. This is the truth about that. And then they want to be able to just follow along and just, oh, okay,
that's
now
why
I know
so
that.
Many people sitting in pews.
Right.
Yeah.
So many uninformed people sitting
right.
in pews. So.
Mm. Goodness. Well, David, thank you and God bless you for this work that you're doing and sharing it with our listeners. This concludes part 10 of The Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And you can read this book online for free at the AskElm.com website. And God willing, we'll be back with David really soon. And God bless all of you out there that are listening. Pay attention. Good night, everybody.